Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much do we know about the nature of the universe and what mysteries remain for science to solve? Life on Earth makes it easy to focus on the stuff we can see and feel and understand. But beyond our cozy atmosphere, the universe is made up overwhelmingly of the particles that hold galaxies together and the force that drives galaxies apart, known as dark matter and dark energy. And it's only been in the past century of human existence that scientists have even begun to define the tantalizing mysteries they present to us, let alone the answers that they might provide as to the origins of the universe itself. Rocky Cobb is Arthur Holly Compton Distinguished Service Professor of Astronomy and Astrophysics at the University of Chicago. He's in town to deliver a public lecture tonight at 7:30 for the 50th Jubilee Texas Symposium on Relativistic Astrophysics at the University of Texas at Dallas. Rocky, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you, Chris. Very nice to be here.
I think it's fascinating that one thing that unites every human society we have a record of is that they have wondered about these mysteries.
That's right. There was a great anthropologist in the 20th century, George Murdoch, and he put together 60 or so what he called cultural universals that every culture throughout history has had, every culture known. And they were some things common. The brewing of alcoholic beverages was one of them.
First things first.
Right. Body adornment, things like that. That was another. And one of the 60 cultural universals is a cosmology. Every culture, every society known has some legend, some myth, some idea about the origin of the universe, the size of the universe, what are stars, a cosmology.
But our attempts to understand it through something other than mythology are relatively recent in our history.
I think it traces back to the beginning of the 20th century and the work of Albert Einstein. Really, to understand the large-scale structure of the universe really requires using Einstein's theory of relativity, his theory of gravity. There are regions in the universe that Newton's description of gravity, a classical description of gravity, just doesn't work. And studying the universe as a whole is one of those places where you need Einstein's theory of relativity.
So Einstein had his theory of relativity and he had his theory of gravity. And then for a while, at least, he described his theory of gravity as like his greatest blunder.
That's right. It's a curious thing. Einstein should have predicted in 1917 the Big Bang. So in end of 1915, beginning of 1916, Einstein perfected his theory of gravity. It's known as the theory of general relativity. One of his first applications was to cosmology, to try to understand the universe. Now, you have to realize Einstein was a person until then had never committed an error in physics. He was batting 1,000. And he was extremely creative and did not accept common knowledge. You know, he really was an outside-the-box thinker. But when he applied his new knowledge to the universe, to cosmology, it was a very conservative approach. So his equations scream out that the universe should be expanding. It should change with time. They really point to a Big Bang. It's almost unavoidable. Einstein saw that, and instead of saying, aha, the universe is expanding, I'm predicting a Big Bang, he said, there must be something wrong with my equations. Equations that it took him 8 years to develop. So he added something that seemed crazy at the time to prevent the universe from expanding. This is known as a cosmological constant. Now, about 12 years later, Edwin Hubble discovered, in fact, that the universe is expanding. So the reason Einstein originally introduced this idea of a cosmological constant was no longer necessary. And he described this introduction of the cosmological constant, this in some sense modification of his great equations, as his biggest blunder.
So when we discover that the universe is expanding, those equations work?
As far as we know, Einstein's theory of gravity applies everywhere in the universe and has applied for all time.
What do we have to understand about the nature of space and time in order to understand the universe? That's maybe the deepest question I've ever asked on this program. But kind of give us the sort of background that we need.
Well, the background that we need, traditionally, cosmology has been the study of what's in the universe and how things move. And with the work of Einstein, we realized that an important part of this is not only a discovery of what's in space, an understanding of what's in space, but an understanding of space and time itself. Mm-hmm. So this is an important part of cosmology today.
So what is the relationship between, well, let's talk about dark energy and dark matter. First of all, dark energy is the thing that is driving galaxies apart, that is expanding the universe. Is that right?
The universe is expanding, but what dark energy seems to do is to cause the expansion velocity of the universe to increase. Mm-hmm. Now, you would think you start with a Big Bang when the universe was expanding incredibly rapidly, but over time, the expansion would slow. The expansion velocity would slow because gravity tends to pull everything back together. Mm-hmm. And what was discovered in 1998, in fact, is that the universe is expanding with a faster velocity today than it was just a few billion years ago. So something is pushing galaxies apart and causing the expansion to accelerate, to go with a faster velocity with time. And this circles back, actually, to Einstein's original idea. I mentioned this cosmological constant that he introduced to try to keep the universe from expanding. But that is a possible explanation for the acceleration of the universe, this cosmological constant. So what Einstein called his biggest blunder may have been one of his most beautiful insights. It may be that Einstein was wrong when he said he was wrong.
Hmm.
And the lesson here is clear, to never admit you're wrong. Einstein could have been famous if he had stuck to his original idea.
Yeah, poor guy. What a sad story.
He's been forgotten
that turned
now.
Out to be. Yeah. But so essentially the cosmological constant just got a sexy new name, is it?
That's right. We have a much different understanding than Einstein originally did when he introduced it. And I think of it, if it is the explanation, I think of it as a weight of empty space. That somehow completely empty space with nothing in it weighs something. That's one explanation for the acceleration of the expansion of the universe. There are other explanations, but the simplest one goes back to Einstein's idea of 1917, which he introduced for the wrong reason.
So, Rocky, how do we go about weighing empty space?
Well, that is something that there's a lot of talks at the meeting this week about, and something that scientists have been scratching their head about since 1998. How do you weigh nothing? You can't put space on a scale. The space under it, so imagine just a balance, scale balance. The space under it, space above it. You can't, what do you compare it to? When you weigh something, you always compare it to something. It could be that the only effect of the weight of space is to cause the universe to expand with this ever-increasing velocity, to cause what's known as the acceleration of the universe.
So if dark matter is pulling things together, then do dark matter and dark energy compete with one another or keep one another in check?
In some sense, they compete with one another on a smaller scale than the entire universe. Dark matter holds galaxies together. It holds all structures that we see in the universe together. There's much more dark matter in the universe than there is matter that we can see. So it's sort of the yin and yang of dark matter and dark energy. One thing's pulling things together, another is pushing things apart.
What's the relationship between dark matter and gravity? How are they different?
Well, dark matter would work in the usual way gravity works. So we see, for 80 years, astronomers have been studying galaxies and in various ways determining the mass of galaxies. And when they determine the mass of galaxies, they can say, now, where is all the matter that we see? That's in the form of stars, but there's not enough stars to make up all of the mass of a galaxy that they determine. And what's left over is dark We don't see it, so it's known as dark matter. And the nature of dark matter and the nature of dark energy are two of the fundamental questions in cosmology today that really defines the forefront of cosmology.
Are they it would be strange to say they're abnormal in some way because they're 95% of the universe together, right?
We only see 5% of the universe. 95% of the universe is a mystery. We don't know what it is. We have ideas of what dark matter might be and what dark energy might be, but they're really names for a mystery. And it's really exciting that there's 95% of the universe yet to discover.
What does it take to determine the mass of a galaxy? I mean, it's probably easier than determining the mass of empty space, but not much, right?
Well, actually, it's something that's well known and well understood. We determine there's dark matter there by observing the motions of things that we do see. So we see stars orbiting about the center of the galaxy. By measuring the velocity of stars orbiting about the center of the galaxy, we can determine the mass of the galaxy. Just as by knowing the velocity of Earth about the sun, we can determine the mass of the sun. No one's put the sun on a scale, right? But we can determine the mass of the sun by knowing the velocity of Earth about the sun. We can determine the mass of a galaxy by determining the velocity of stars about the center of the galaxy. There are many other ways to do that, and everything's more or less consistent.
How precise can you be with those calculations?
Precise to 10% or so on the mass of what's missing. So when you say 95% is missing and what's dark and not, it might be 96, might be 94, but most of it is missing. That much is clear.
So it must have been, an exciting thing, but also, is it sort of a frightening thing when you're the one to discover that there's so much that we don't know?
Well, one thing that motivates scientists is to understand something that other people don't. So I'd really love to be the person who one day looks at the data they've taken from a telescope or looks at the result of a collision at the CERN Hadron Collider. And of the 6 billion people in the world, there'll be one person for one instant who will know what the universe is made of. That's going to happen once in human history. And that drives scientists to stay up all night looking through telescopes, to work very hard at accelerators, keeps me scribbling on my pad. I'm a theorist. I just use a pencil and paper. And when I have a bad day, I use an eraser. A good day, I don't need an eraser. Bad day, I need an eraser. And it drives us to be the person to know this.
Are astrophysicists journalists keep all their old notebooks just in case there's something you need later. Do you keep all your pads and papers just in case something you thought of 10 years ago suddenly becomes relevant?
Well, I keep a lot of it because it turns out that occasionally I'm doing calculations and I realize, wait a minute, I've already done this working on another problem or on another aspect of something. You know, I've seen this movie before. I know how this turns out, and I have to dig up what I've done before. Sometimes it's simpler to do it over than to go through my files trying to find out what you've done before.
Rocky Cobb is my guest. He's Arthur Holly Compton Distinguished Service Professor of Astronomy and Astrophysics at the University of Chicago, in town to deliver a public lecture tonight at 7:30 for the 50th Jubilee Texas Symposium on Relativistic Astrophysics at the University of Texas at Dallas. If you have a question about the nature of the universe, you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372, send email to think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is astrophysicist Rocky Cobb. He's a professor of astronomy and astrophysics at the University of Chicago, and he's in town to deliver a public lecture tonight to the Texas Symposium on Relativistic Astrophysics at the University of Texas at Dallas. If you want to be part of the conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Before we move on, Rocky, can you talk a little bit about the conference itself and what happens there and how this highly respected event has come to take place every year here in North Texas?
Well, the event started in Dallas in 1963. This is the 50th anniversary of the first Texas Symposium. In 1963, astronomers and relativists, people who study Einstein's theory of relativity, basically didn't talk to one another. They didn't think they had anything in common to say to one another. And in 1963, there were two things that happened that really gave the impetus for this first conference in Dallas. One was the discovery of the nature of quasars, the idea that quasars are extremely bright and extremely far away. And when astrophysicists scratch their heads about what can produce this much energy, the conclusion that they came to is it must be something to do with black holes. So that is relativistic. So that was an observational discovery about the distance to quasars. The second discovery we came to appreciate more after 1963 was a mathematical description of spinning black holes, which first unveiled here in Texas in 1963. So the first Texas Symposium was the first real conference that brought astronomers and relativists, theoretical physicists who study Einstein's theory, together to talk about common problems. It was not an easy marriage. It took a while to get used to one another. The astronomers really didn't know anything about relativity, and many of the relativists didn't really know very much about the data and what goes on in astronomy. But it was born here 50 years ago, and this conference has moved around the country. It's been in Dallas around the world, actually. It's been meetings in Florence, in San Paulo, really around the world. And now it's back in Dallas because it is the 50th anniversary, and it is the premier conference in this area.
Does it still shake out to sort of sharks on one side and jets on the other?
Yes, it does. I mean, but we listen to one another now. Uh-huh. At first, we didn't think the other people had anything to say. So the relativists were very mathematical. And the astronomers really didn't understand the mathematics, and the astronomers were very down-to-earth, talking about data and reduction of data and uncertainty, and the theorists really didn't appreciate that. But they've grown that they talk to each other now. They may not completely understand each other, but it's maybe a functional marriage, maybe not an ideal marriage yet.
So you mentioned the Large Hadron Collider in the last segment, and of course that one of the most important things it was doing was looking to confirm the existence of the Higgs boson. Is that right? And
that's
happened
right.
Last year. Mm-hmm. Not a surprise, really, to people who were working on this, but why is that so important and what can we learn from that confirmation?
Well, rather than the Higgs, let me talk about how the Hadron Collider – I'll talk about the Higgs in a moment – how it can be used to study dark matter.
Great.
One of the most promising ideas for the nature of dark matter is that it is a new, yet-to-be-discovered elementary particle, not the Higgs, but a particle that, like the Higgs, has not been discovered yet. We think it was produced in the hot primordial soup of the Big Bang, a billionth of a second or so after the bang, when the universe had incredibly high temperatures and enough energy in the thermal soup in the primordial soup to make these particles that we think is the dark matter. We call them WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles. So if this is right, the universe is dominated by WIMPs. The revenge of the nerds, yes. Now, at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, when protons are collided together at very high energy, for a brief instant, we can recreate the conditions that were present in the primordial soup. So if the WIMPs were made in the primordial soup of the Big Bang, we should be able to make them in the primordial soup at CERN. So perhaps we're making them now, but they're hard to see because they don't interact. They're dark. So it's trying to sift through all of the collisions and all of the information to see evidence of something you've produced but you don't see.
So how will we know when we've found it or if we've created it?
There's a couple of ways we're looking for WIMPs. One is at CERN, at the Large Hadron Collider. Another way we're looking for WIMPs is in underground laboratories. The idea that a WIMP that's around and is the dark matter will pass through the Earth and slightly nudge a single nucleus in some sort of detector that's underground, leaving a very faint signal that we can detect. Another way of looking for WIMPs is by looking at the center of our galaxy. Presumably, there's a large concentration of WIMPs at the center of our galaxy that's annihilating today, perhaps producing gamma rays or X-rays or some type of particle that we can see. I don't think there's any one moment that we'll say, Eureka, we've discovered the WIMP. It's going to require evidence, because it's so elusive and so important, evidence from different ways of looking for WIMPs.
So when the Big Bang happened, there was all this energy released. There was hydrogen, there was helium. How did we end up with all the other heavy elements that make up, you know, you and me and everything that we've ever touched?
That's really a beautiful story. So the universe started with a primordial soup of all of the elementary particles. Then, as the universe expanded and cooled, quarks got together to form neutrons and protons, the fundamental building blocks of nuclei. Then about 3 minutes after the bang, the neutrons and protons came together to form mostly hydrogen and helium, a little bit of lithium. So after the first day of the universe, it was hydrogen and helium and lithium. Now, you are much more than hydrogen and helium. There's calcium in your bones, iron in your blood, oxygen in your lungs. All of these elements had to be produced someplace that has extremely high temperature and energy to fuse the primordial hydrogen and helium together. Mm-hmm. That happened in the interior of stars. So every atom in your body that's not hydrogen and helium or lithium was made in a star in some nuclear reaction. So you and everybody out there are star material. Or your nuclear waste. You know, there are different ways you can look at it. I like to think
days,
of myself as star material and not nuclear waste. But it was made in stars. And this was an understanding that started in the late 1930s when we figured out what powers the sun. And in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, we did experiments in laboratories measuring how to make different nuclei and working out the origin of all of the different nuclei, all of the different elements of the periodic table, what sort of stars they came from, was it an exploding star? And we have a pretty good idea now for the origin of the elements.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Russell in Dallas. Hey, Russell.
Hey, Ms. Boyd, Dr. Cobb. Thanks for taking my call.
Welcome.
Hi, my question is about dark matter and dark energy, and I've always had a hard time wrapping my head around that idea. Just, you know, from what I understand, there are these different forces in the universe, nuclear forces, you know, electromagnetism, gravity, and the fact that dark matter is supposed to comprise 95% of the universe, and that's the massive nature of the dark matter that's pulling everything apart. It seems to me like is it not possible there's another force out there, maybe like a that has a repulsive nature that's driving the universe apart that maybe we haven't discovered yet? And that's my question.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks for calling, Russell. So you said you have trouble wrapping your head about these ideas. Well, welcome to my world. I struggle with it every day, and it is a challenge. But you bring up an interesting point that the answer – so dark matter and dark energy are names of phenomena that we see and we don't understand. We've given them names, but naming is not explaining. The idea that dark matter is a WIMP, a new type of elementary particle, and that dark energy is the weight of space, Einstein's cosmological constant, are amazing and incredible, but they're the most conservative explanations that we know. The true explanation might be something unglimpsed at now, something that we don't know, something that will be completely new. And that also is very exciting. So no matter what the answer is to dark matter and dark energy, it's guaranteed to be really amazing and really exciting. And that makes it worth devoting, in my opinion, devoting your life to studying. So you're right. It might be a new force or something completely different. You know, there may be – maybe we need a new Einstein out there somewhere to come up with the idea. So it's a very good point that you bring up and something we're very aware of.
How much can all these ideas be tested empirically?
Well, that's a good question. So the idea of a WIMP, dark matter, if dark matter is a WIMP, that will be tested, and it will be tested in this decade. It's not something that we'll do 100 years from now or 50 years from now. Within this decade, we have the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, which is powerful enough to produce WIMPs. It'll be hard to find them, but it's powerful enough to produce them. We have underground experiments that are sensitive enough to detect the relic WIMPs. And finally, we have satellites and telescopes sensitive enough to look at the galactic center of the Milky Way and see whether WIMPs are annihilating. It's just a matter of refining our experiments, improving them a little bit, and being patient. But in this decade, we will know the answer to the question of whether dark matter is a WIMP. So this is the wimpy decade for us. We'll know the answer in this decade.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Steve in Dallas. Hey, Steve.
Hi. This is a simple question. I'm in my mid-50s, but I do like to think I'm uneducated. But I want to know, what is the direction of the center of the universe? Or do we even know that?
Yeah.
Hi,
Steve. So the center of our galaxy, which is not the center of the universe, is in the direction of Sagittarius, the constellation Sagittarius. So tomorrow at noon, it's very close to where the sun is. So tomorrow at noon, it's going to be clear in Dallas, I'm sure. Look up to the sun and look a little bit to the east, and that's the center of our galaxy. Now, your question really has to do with the center of the universe. It's in Texas, of course. It's well known that the center of the universe is Texas.
That's a perfect answer. Thank you very much.
But actually, the more scientific answer is that the universe has no center. And it has no edge. It has no boundary. One of the most difficult concepts to get across to me when I'm teaching or lecturing, whether it's high school students, college students, or graduate students, is a concept of an explosion, a Big Bang, that doesn't have a center and doesn't have an edge. And one way to think about it, it's very difficult for graduate students, given a 9-week course. So in the next 30 seconds, I would just say that you have to imagine the Big Bang as an explosion of space, that space is emerging, being created between every galaxy, and there's no center to that explosion. When we think classically of a concept of an explosion or a Big Bang, we think like a firecracker, that it's galaxies flying off into empty space. But that's not the Big Bang. The Big Bang is more of a creation of space. I hope that helps a little bit.
Given the current thinking about dark matter and dark energy and other things, what is the current belief about whether the universe will expand infinitely or whether it will at some point collapse upon itself?
If dark matter is a cosmological constant, then the future, the far distant future of the universe, is a cold, dark place. the universe will expand forever, ever accelerating. And the galaxies that we see now, the distant galaxies, will expand so far away from us and expand with such a large velocity that we won't be able to see them. So we will be alone in the universe.
But wouldn't there be, and forgive this question, but couldn't there be sort of urban sprawl in the form of new stars being created and filling in that space between galaxies?
No, we don't think so. That stars are created when galaxies are created. And, you know, the star formation history of the universe is something that that's really interesting. And it could, it's stars form from gas. It could be that the universe is running out of gas. And we've already reached the peak of star formation. But star formation is local in our galaxy. Stars will continue to be born, but at a slower rate.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Pedro in Dallas. Hi, Pedro.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question about black holes. Do we know, do we know where matter goes after it goes into a black hole? And if we don't know what happens to it, I always thought that since we don't know, that might be like creation of another Big Bang at the other side of that black hole.
That's a beautiful question, and I can give you a definitive answer that we really don't know. And, boy, if you would be at the meeting this week, the Texas Symposium on Relativistic Astrophysics, you would have listened to a lot of talks, speculation at this point, because no one's really gone into a black hole and come back to tell us about it, about whether black holes can give birth to additional universes and what happens to the singularity at the center of the black hole. This is really at the forefront of what's being discussed this week. So it's a really good question, and boy, I wish I knew the answer to it.
Rocky Cobb is here. He is Arthur Holly Compton Distinguished Service Professor of Astronomy and Astrophysics at the University of Chicago. He's in town to deliver a public lecture tonight for the 50th Jubilee Texas Symposium on Relativistic Astrophysics at UT Dallas. Tickets for that have all been claimed, but you can continue listening and you can call in now with your questions at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Rocky Cobb, who is professor of astronomy and astrophysics at the University of Chicago, in town to lecture tonight for the 50th Jubilee Texas Symposium on Relativistic Astrophysics at the University of Texas at Dallas. Join us by sending a tweet to me at Chris Boyd Think, by emailing think@kera.org, or by calling 1-800-933-5372. We have an email here from Philip, who asks, does energy have mass? And if not, how is it possible to weigh the energy that is powering galactic movement?
Well, that's a good question. So when I talk about dark energy and dark mass, dark matter, I relate them by using the one equation that everyone's familiar with, E equals MC squared. So it's Einstein's equation relating the equivalence of energy and mass. So I can compare dark energy to dark mass and talk about a weight of energy by using E equals MC squared. My favorite equation.
It's just so beautiful and elegant. And, you know, it strikes me, and I know you've spoken about this in other places, but all of these questions are pretty simple. It's the answers that are so hard.
So one of the great things about being a cosmologist is the questions are so simple. What is the universe made of? It's a simple question. How old is the universe? Why is there a universe? Where did it come from? It's questions a 4-year-old might ask. The answers sometimes are not so simple, but the questions are really basic and simple. And I can convey to any interested person, I think, the questions. The answers I'm not sure about. It's a mystery, right? My lecture this evening is Mysteries of the Dark Universe. If I knew the answer, it wouldn't be a mystery. So the answers are complicated, but the questions are simple. What is the makeup of the universe?
Is there adequate funding these days for this kind of pure science?
Well, I am very grateful for the funding that we do have. So you, your listeners, citizens of our country, citizens throughout the world, take from their needs and wants money that they happily pay as taxes. And some of that, some small sliver of that, goes for basic research to advance our understanding of the universe. Now, whether it's enough, it's like asking someone, you know, is your salary high enough or something like that? You know, the answer, of course, I would say no. But I never stop being grateful for what we do have and what we are enabled to do.
1-800, that was very tactfully put. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Stephen in Plano. Hey, Stephen.
Hi, Chris. We were talking earlier about the cosmological constant and how it's made a comeback in view of dark matter. My question relates to the discovery of the Higgs boson and the explanation of the Higgs field and how that sort of seems to be a cosmological molasses that all mass moves through. And that sounds like the old concept of the ether. Is that making a comeback too?
Well, Higgs is very interesting, and I'm glad you asked that question because I can circle back to Chris's question about the Higgs. The Higgs tells us something about dark energy, about the weight of space, the mass density, the energy density of space, but we don't quite understand it. So the Higgs particle is an excitation of something that we call the Higgs field that permeates all of space. You describe it as a molasses. And that's not a bad analogy, but it permeates all of space and gives quarks and electrons and particles like that mass. So every place in the universe is at has a certain Higgs potential energy. This Higgs potential energy everywhere in the universe is 246 billion electron volts of energy. In the Higgs field. There's a tremendous energy in the vacuum, in nothing, associated with the Higgs field. Now, don't be alarmed. You won't be, let's see, you wouldn't be electrocuted. I guess you'd be Higgs-acuted by this tremendous energy in the Higgs field, but it's everywhere in the universe. And what electrocutes you is potential energy differences, electrical energy differences, like putting one hand on a high-tension wire and the other hand on the ground. So it's the difference that matters. So the average, if the Higgs field is the same everywhere, the only way to detect it is through the expansion of the universe. So the Higgs field should contribute somehow to Einstein's cosmological constant. The problem is, if you would estimate how much it would contribute, it contributes many, 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 many times more than what we actually see. So something has to cancel it, and that's what we don't understand. One of the things we don't understand.
Rocky, if multiple universes are possible or indeed exist, will we ever be able to know this?
Well, scientists should not say never about what will be known. And although I've said this today, you should be cautious when a scientist tells you, we will discover this, or we will know the answer to this. So I'm reluctant to say we will never know about multiverses. We will, if we discover multiverses and learn about them, it will not be classically by looking through a telescope and seeing them. It will be some subtle quantum effect or some subtle thing that we don't quite understand now. But 100 years ago, we thought our galaxy, the Milky Way, was the only galaxy in the universe. And people would say there might be other galaxies, but we'll never be able to know. Eventually, we figured out how to know. And if there are multiverses, I think we'll eventually figure out how to disprove it or give evidence for it or against it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Manfred in Dallas. Hi, Manfred.
Hi. Thank you for your explanation about the Big Bang as the creation of space. It's very elegant. Anyways, my question is that are we sure that the laws of physics true even in outer space? For example, if we look farther down the universe, we look farther down in time because we assume that the speed of light is constant. Can we ever be sure, since all our measuring instruments are earthbound or some are out there in space, but not far out in space, can we be sure that we're measuring things or our calculations are correct?
Hmm. Well, thanks for the question. That is something we ask ourselves, and we probe and test this idea. Although our telescopes are relatively near to Earth, even the ones in orbit or out in space are very close to Earth on an astronomical scale, we can use telescopes to look out in space to see if the laws of physics are the same wherever we look out in space. Telescopes are also time machines, that the farther out we look in space, the further back in time we see, because it takes light time to reach us. So we can look out in space and back in time and ask the question, do the laws of physics seem to be the same billions of years ago as they are now? Is the charge of the electron the same today as it was billions of years ago? Could fundamental constants change? And as far as we can tell, as far as we've measured, as far as we've probed, the laws of nature that we have operating here in Texas today in 2013 are the same laws of nature that have always operated throughout the history of the universe and everywhere in the universe. But we're still looking, and we may find one day a change in that thinking. But that's a question we do ask, and we are able to give some answers.
Back to the phones now. This time we have Ray on the line in Dallas. Hi, Ray.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question relates to an earlier discussion on the edge of the universe. What evidence do we have to convince ourselves that the universe does have an edge? And if the evidence isn't solid enough to be completely convincing, is anybody searching for the weight of the dark matter that is so elusive within our universe? Are they actually looking outside the universe to potentially other universes surrounding our universe?
Well, occasionally astronomers and cosmologists talk about the edge of the universe, but what they really mean is the edge of the visible universe. Because the universe has only a finite age, 13.6 billion years or so, large but finite age, we can only see a certain distance out into space. So there's an edge to the visible universe, but that doesn't mean the universe ends as far as we can see. Our understanding is that it continues, and there is no edge to the universe. Now, there may be multiverses where one universe begins and another ends, and if there is a multiverse, a multitude of universes, then it could be an infinite number of universes where all things are possible. So there will be other universes where Dallas beat Chicago on Monday.
You know, I thought about
just not our universe.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I'll leave all football out of the discussion so that we'll stay safe after the conversation. You know, I thought about this a lot because I have only obviously a layperson's understanding of these things, but it's pretty easy to understand that as a human experiences it, time doesn't exist until we have moved into that moment to inhabit it, right? Time doesn't really exist before the time that we're living in, but we're totally comfortable with the idea of that. But somehow space, we can't get our heads around it. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. It is a difficult concept. And to think about what space is like, what is space like if there's no matter? What is time? I spend many moments thinking about the nature of time. What is time like? What is the fundamental property of space? What do we mean when we say space? And it's not so easy to answer. And it doesn't keep me up at night, maybe, but I think about it at odd times.
Do these questions and the potential answers to them offer the kind of fulfillment of our quest to understand the purpose of human life in the same way that religion has functioned for centuries and eons?
Well, a fundamental question is, what is our place in the universe? And there are many ways to that has been asked. And throughout history, our attempts to answer the question, what is our place in the universe, has been influenced by our perception, our idea of what is the universe. So we'll never know our place in the universe, never understand our place in the universe until we understand a more fundamental question, that is, what is the universe?
I wonder, as a scientist, if you ever fantasized about how different your life might be and what you could know if you were born 100 years after the day you were actually born.
I would love to know the answers. And, you know, scientists will know much more. Science is cumulative. It's an amazing thing. So I know much more science. I'm not about a scientist, but I know much more science than Einstein or Newton or these brilliant people who were incredible scientists, because it's a cumulative thing. I'm not sure the same thing could be said about writers or musicians or, you know. Sure, it's cumulative in some ways, but is a musician today, do they know much more about music than Beethoven or Mozart or somebody like that knew? I'm not sure.
Well, it's a double-edged sword, I guess, because on the one hand, you get to know more than Einstein and Newton, and yet are you left envying someone in the future who will know a great deal more than you get to know?
I'm not envious of them. I can't wait to find out what the answer is and what if I can just make some small contribution towards someone in the future's understanding. That's really what I want to do.
Is there anything in your life, is there any dumb thing you do to unwind from all these enormous, weighty questions that keep you awake at night?
Well, I go to the opera.
Really? And, well, that's not so dumb.
Well, I don't know. You sit there and listen. I sing in the opera, but the people around me don't particularly care for that.
That's not Real Housewives.
Or I go to, you know, I'll go to sporting events or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Just a normal life when I'm not thinking about the universe.
Is it something that does creep up on you when you don't think that you're working on a problem? Is it still with you? You're taking a walk around the block?
Oh, yeah. Sometimes to really advance in your research, sometimes you have to put something away and you say, well, I'm not going to think about this. And then you wake up in the morning or, you know, while showering or shaving or something like that, you think of some answer, even when you're not thinking about it. It cogitates in the back of your mind someplace. And sometimes you have to do that.
Rocky Cobb is Arthur Holly Compton Distinguished Service Professor of Astronomy and Astrophysics at the University of Chicago. He's in town to deliver a public lecture tonight for the 50th Jubilee Texas Symposium on Relativistic Astrophysics at the University of Texas at Dallas. Rocky, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.